This is the Line 4 podcast. I'm Will Bardwell. A strange thing has been happening in the real estate market over the past 2 years. When the COVID-19 pandemic exploded in earnest in early 2020, it plunged the global economy into a short but massive recession. Technically, the recession only lasted 2 months, but the global economy has been struggling to recover ever since. The American job force is still about 4 million people short of where it was in late 2019. And global supply chain disruptions have created chaos everywhere from new home construction to retail sales to car rentals. The real estate market, though, has rarely been more active. Housing prices have soared thanks to low supply and feverish demand, and mortgage rates have rarely been cheaper. So even with the challenges associated with buying, demand has been persistent. This defiance of the broader economy's malaise has even extended to an unlikely segment of the real estate market: golf course construction. Ever since the Great Recession in 2007, demand for golf courses has plummeted. New construction has fallen, and America's supply of golf courses fell as more than 800 courses closed. But since the pandemic began, that has changed. More than 500,000 people picked up golf in 2020, and the number of rounds played was up 20%. And with that increase in demand, golf course construction is doing something that even just a couple of years ago seemed unthinkable. It's picking up.
This is the first time that I can remember I have 4 projects that I've signed NDA and non-disclosure agreements on.
That's Nathan Crace, a Mississippi golf course architect whose work includes new designs and renovation work across the South.
I think it's just a little more indicative of the times we're in because golf has exploded, you know, because of the pandemic. It was one of the only things you could go out and safely do. You can do it outside. You can naturally socially distance yourself from the people you're playing with.
Crace isn't alone. We won't know exactly how dramatic the increase in golf course construction is until the National Golf Foundation tallies figures at the end of the year. But across the industry, designers are unveiling renovation work and even new designs at a pace not seen in recent memory. And it's happening at a moment when the entire industry has had more than a decade to reflect on the mistakes of the 1990s and early 2000s, and to put those lessons into action with golf courses that leave smaller environmental footprints and are just more fun to play for golfers of all skill levels. So today on the Line 4 podcast, we're going to talk to 3 architects about their workloads and what they're seeing outside their own practices and across the broader industry. I was on Instagram at some point in the past few months, and you know, how to like make these suggestions when you're scrolling through about, you know, here's an account you should follow. And it suggested for me that one day it was like, you should follow Red Feather Golf Club. And I thought, well, I'd never heard of that. I don't know anything about that. But I kind of filed it away. Then it seemed like not long after that, y'all broke ground. I mean, it really seemed like it came together quickly. Is that right? Or was I imagining that?
Well, on the public side of things, it did come together rather quickly. On the reality side of things, it was a little bit more typically paced.
That's Rob Collins, who by this point needs no introduction. But in case you've been in a cave for the past 7 years, Rob and his partner, Tad King, designed Sweetens Cove in Tennessee. And they've also nearly completed work at Landman Golf Club in northeastern Nebraska, which is on track to open in mid-2022, and at Overton Park in Memphis, which also will open in 2022. Their latest project is a course called Red Feather near Lubbock in northwest Texas.
We were contacted by J.J., last summer.
And who's JJ?
JJ Killeen. He has the West Texas Driving Range Pro Twitter account. Right. And he's gonna be the resident pro and kind of gatekeeper of Red Feather. So JJ had heard about Sweetens, and he's really good close friends with Brad Roston, our client. and he suggested that Brad get in touch with us. Brad had interviewed a few other architects about possibly doing it, and this was last summer. And JJ reached out to us. Of course, we responded and were immediately interested. It was very clear that, you know, right away it was a real deal. And this is actually pretty funny. Brad is a great guy, a lot of fun. And it was his dream to do this project. And like I said, he had, you know, talked to a few other people, and Tad and I came to town, and we sat down and we started talking, and we hit it off immediately. And he looked at me, and he this is just a few weeks ago. He goes, Rob, right then, I knew y'all were my motherfuckers. and I just loved that. The only hurdle was, you know, trying to figure out how to build a golf course. It's basically a big 135-acre square, but it's a lot more heavily engineered than some of our other projects, because the golf course sits in what's called a playa lake. And that is basically a dry drainage area that drains, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres around that site. All the water from that area drains down into this low spot, and it then seeps into the ground. The ground percolates well and it goes away, but for obvious reasons, you can't disturb these playa lakes and mess up the amount of storage capacity that they have. Otherwise, right, it completely ruins the surrounding drainage area. So it's heavily engineered, and we had to, you know, create a cut and fill plan that accommodated all of this runoff from around the area and would allow water to get through the ground and do what it's historically done, but in this case, do it in a golf environment. And so there were a lot of hurdles to jump through with the engineer to get this project to the point where we could actually start construction. And there were a number of different edits on that cut and fill plan and so forth. And so we knew for quite a while that this was, you know, again, a very real project. And we always felt like we were banking on this one happening, like, because we hit it off so well with Brad, we were like, we're going to do this one. It's just a matter of getting over the finish line with the engineering. And then once that happens, it'll move pretty quickly. And that's probably about the time you picked it up on your radar screen. And I think the routing kind of went public on Twitter and stuff. And then it was very quickly after that that we started. So not too different from the site that the old Sequatchie Valley was on, very similar to Tom Doak's site that he had for the Rawls course at Texas Tech, which that was one of his biggest earth moving projects as well. You know, dead flat. I think they moved around 1 million cubes or something like that. That's about what we're going to move, about 1 million cubic yards to make it work. And conform to this engineered deal that we have to meet. So
what's the golf course going to be like?
I'm super excited for the golf course. It's Red Feather's going to be a private golf course. And because of the fact that there's not really tee times, and most everyone who plays it will know their way around, we were able to do some things you know, might not be able to do in a public course. You know, I was able to do really, really close green to tee connections, which we like. We have Landman and stuff like that, but because it's a really tight routing, there's a lot of shared fairways, a lot of shared hitting areas, shared tees. There's three double greens, a really fun finish that, I call the Allen finish after our friend John Allen. I think I told you this one time. He's like, you know, I think the best finish is a drivable par four, a short three, and a reachable five. And so because it was a blank slate, it was like, yeah, I think that I agree with you on that. So we put the Allen finish in there. It finishes with the short three, drivable four, short three, reachable five. That's the order of 16, 17, and 18. Garrett Holt, the superintendent, came from Shady Oaks, and he's does a phenomenal job in his turf care. And so we'll have really, really firm and fast, tight surrounds everywhere, fairway everywhere, fast greens. We're doing a zoysia grass that you can mow super low, and it's going to be a blast. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
When these sorts of things start percolating, you know, whether it's Red Feather, Landman, any of the other stuff y'all get contacted about, like, is it literally just a phone call or an email, or is it something different than that?
It can, a lot of times it is a phone call or an email. Sometimes it's different.
I would hate it if I like had to pick up my phone for every number that I don't know what it is.
luckily,
send it straight to voicemail.
Yeah. Luckily I've learned that calls from some random city in Tennessee that have kind of a weird number, I'm learning about my warranty on my car that's due, or there's something wrong with my social security number. But you do end up picking up some numbers, you know, just in hopes. We get a lot of, I would say 80% of them are kind of out of the blue calls, and then other ones are maybe an introduction or something like that.
Okay. Are you getting more of those outreaches now than you were, say, 18 months ago?
Definitely. Yeah, I think the industry, I think the industry as a whole is really picking up. I think, you know, that's definitely not unique to us. We certainly are seeing a lot of traction and interest.
I remember looking, I can't remember whether it was last year, but the National Golf Foundation keeps track of these numbers, you know, how many courses open in a given year. And it was either 2020 or 2019, and there were like 9 new 18-hole golf courses in America. It was just it was a dead bottom number. Do you have any theories about why things seem to be picking up?
I think that, when Tad and I formed King Collins, we said, look, if we can just get one in the ground and show what we can do, we can come out of this recession, that being the Great Recession. And you know, that will springboard us to hopefully be able to do more. That was the plan. And the thought was that there had been so many uninteresting golf courses built during the boom time that this Great Recession potentially could have a long, very long-term positive impact on the golf industry, where the golf industry started to shift towards more focus on doing things that are golf centric, putting golf first, and not so one cookie cutter course after another that's related to being an amenity for something bigger, like a real estate development. That's not to say that there aren't still real estate driven projects where the golf course is an amenity, but we have not been contacted for a single project, real estate related, where the golf course is not a core driving entity. It's not just a cast off like it was back in the 2000s. In other words, it's all core golf. The golf is has a spotlight shining on it. It's really important. And the houses are maybe around it. That's at Red Feather, for instance, there's going to be houses around the edges of the course, not on the interior. You know, the golf course is a standalone thing. And that's, I think that we're seeing part of that prediction becoming a reality, where developers are realizing that, you know, we put the golf first and that works. Also, I think that, you know, generally speaking, there's a resurgence among the, you know, millennial age demographic in golf. I mean, I think we see that without a doubt. And that's kind of happening.
Yeah, that's that's really interesting that maybe we've reached an inflection point where, you know, people, and by people, I mean like the golfing public, has sort of decided we don't want this sort of one size fits all type golf course anymore. We want more interesting, unique designs, and that this uptick you're seeing, you know, it probably never reaches anything close like the development numbers you were seeing in the 90s, but that the demand for that more unique, you know, that more unique experience, that the demand is finally kind of catching up to folks who can make it materialize.
That's right. There's a demand for compelling architecture and interesting things being built. And I don't think that there's really a ceiling on that. I mean, there's so many opportunities to improve existing properties, or, you know, create new golf in places where there's a lot of demand. One potential project that we have is in a Southern American city that basically doesn't have very many interesting golf courses, but has a massive and growing population. It's like the numbers simply work. I mean, and there's a lot of places like that where that's possible. I mean, we're, you know, in Washington, D.C., I think, you know, there's going to be the big push to redo some of those public golf courses, which will be a hit. I mean, Overton Park is an example. I think our project in Jackson, Brazenhead is an example of that. There's, there's a lot of people in Jackson, Mississippi who like to play golf, but there's not a ton of great options.
I thought you were referring to Jackson when you said that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, that's another project, but Jackson's an example of how that project will be successful, because there's a pent up demand and there's a lack of inventory of compelling golf. And, there's so many places across the country where that's the case. And, you know, we'll never get back to, you know, 300 golf courses a year being built domestically. And that's probably a good thing, but, the ones that are built, by and large, clients are seeking out, they want something compelling and interesting and heartfelt and well done, you know, something that's not just a cast off assembly line type of deal.
Where are y'all on Red Feather right now?
Real heavy earth moving right now. We're getting close to having three holes rough shaped. Then we'll start, you know, kind of putting some features together over the next month, you know, start to dial in some of these holes that are kind of roughed in. And then we're, you know, gonna, you know, work to have it grassed out, you know, sometime next year. We'll work through the winter and then have it grassed out. I mean, it's a ton of earth moving because of the nature of the site, but one advantage is that, it is a compact site, and it's not like Landman, where that was also a lot of earth moving, but it was so massive that it took longer to kind of tie the pieces together there than it will at Red Feather, because it's shorter pushes and it's 135 acre box. It's not spread out over 500 acres like Landman.
You know, Landman is almost a done deal. It looks incredible. Red Feather very much just kind of getting going. Overton Park a little closer to where Landman is. What sort of challenges are you seeing, like looking for supplies, looking for labor? I mean, that's kind of an issue everywhere right now. Is that showing up in golf course construction?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely an issue. Labor is a challenge, and supplies are a challenge. Irrigation supplies have gone way up in cost. And we were telling Will,
by the way, that's Will Anderson, the developer at Landman,
out at Landman, that, you know, had he waited another year to do his project, you know, his cost on irrigation alone would have been way higher. I mean, they hit the timing right where they were able to get that material in the ground before the cost really spiked. And we had a guy out at Red Feather. We're having a hard time finding truck drivers to haul the material around. And there was an 18-year-old kid who came up, and I think he was making a salary of like $3,500, $4,000 a month, something like that, at 18 years old. If I'd made $4,000 a month when I was 18 years old, I mean,
you'd never seen me in college.
I would have had like gold teeth. I wouldn't have known what to do with myself. And this kid bumped around in that thing for a day and was like, yeah, I don't really feel like doing this anymore. And it's like, what? Like, you can't, are you insane? You're 18. You have no skills. I mean, this is a lot of money. Like, it's, I don't know.
It's tough.
It's interesting.
What's driving the uptick in the cost of irrigation supplies?
Probably a lot of it, I would imagine, is related to oil costs, and then
okay.
I guess part of it too is just the supply chain issues. Maybe it's
fair enough. Are you having trouble finding shapers, or is there, you know, or is that still doable?
Yeah, right now, no. We have worked hard to cultivate a tightly knit crew of guys who want to work with us, that we want to work with, and we're getting that going. And Mark and, you know, everybody that was out at Landman is shifting over to Red Feather, and John Ellsworth is our lead earth moving guru at Red Feather, and he's just crushing it out there, and he was at Landman as well. And you know, we'll keep rolling with those guys as long as they'll keep rolling with us. I mean, they do an amazing job. And you know, there is a free agency market. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Jeff Bradley will join us in Texas this winter. I'm hoping we can get enough built for him to come in and knock out a bunch of bunkers. And that's a lot of the way this works is, you know, does somebody, or does like a really talented person like Jeff have a window to pop in? Because naturally Jeff is of course loyal to Cork Crenshaw, and is going to, if Bill and Ben have a job that's going on, I mean, he's going to do that. And we understand that. But if we, like, if there's a 3 or 4 month window where he's got a break or something, you know, like, and it lines up with us, and we're loving it, you know? So I'm hoping that can work out. It's just, there's a lot of shifting schedules you have to try to accommodate. And like I mentioned, Mark Berger's coming over. So Mark's son is working for us now too, which is great.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So we got a nice little crew going.
Is Red Feather looking then at 2023 opening?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, 2022 is already going to be pretty busy for y'all. Landman's opening, Over the Park will open.
Yeah. We'll start Brazenhead. We're going to, we've got another renovation project that we're going to squeeze in the summertime, kind of after Brazenhead. And then we'll do that concurrently as we're finishing Red Feather. And then we're talking about, with a couple different people, about a possible fall start on a new project. And we've got, I would call it, 3 absolute dream projects that are percolating in the ether that I hope to hell happen.
You mentioned in one of our text messages recently that you kind of felt like y'all were a phone call or two away from being blocked up for the next 3 years. And yeah, I think that's interesting that, you know, this, what we're seeing here with this uptick in construction, at least from, you know, that the anecdote of y'all's portfolio, it doesn't look like it's a blip in time, that it's, you know, it's a demand that is stretching out at least the next 24, 36 months.
I think that's true. And I think that's industry wide. I mean, barring some freakish thing with the economy that nobody can foresee, which is always a possibility, but I think things are going to be stable enough that's going to happen. And going back to the first part of our conversation, I think that undoubtedly there's a demand there for, you know, compelling, interesting golf. You know, an example of that is the exciting news that we just saw about Yale, you know, is going to redo their golf course, and they hired Gil to do it, and that's going to turn out great. And I don't know the story behind it, but it's kind of like, holy, you guys have been sitting on this amazing gym for, and people have been telling you about it for the last 25 or 30 years, and finally you're getting around to doing it. Maybe they finally realize that, hey, this makes sense to do it, because.
Although it does make me wonder, I mean, you hear about these places all the time that, like, man, if these folks could ever pull together the capital for a renovation, like, how awesome could this place be? And, I mean, and Yale, you know, Yale's so good that it kind of rose above even that. But
yeah,
at least in the last few years, people have been a lot more open and honest about the shape that the course was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder now, like, is there enough of a reservoir of those places that you could start seeing some restoration / renovation work trickling out of that reservoir?
Yeah, I think you can assume that there will be. I mean, Lookout Mountain's a good example of that. They've got an exciting kind of restoration coming up. Kyle Franz is going to come in and implement the remainder of the Hans plan, I believe sometime next year. And that's going to really, I mean, that place is already great, kind of like Yale, and that'll really push that over the edge. I've been talking with Ari and Patrick.
And that's Ari Techner, who was a co-founder at Sweetens Cove, and Patrick Boyd, who was Sweetens Cove's first general manager.
I've been talking with Ari and Patrick for years about if they could ever actually pull the trigger on this thing and push Lookout over the edge. I mean, it's kind of one of the under the radar, really awesome American golf courses that could be just on a whole nother level. And I think that's what's about to happen.
Well, and since you mentioned Kyle Franz, I mean, Southern Pines, same kind of thing.
Yep, exactly.
I'm going to knock on wood, not just for you, but selfishly, you know, it's a fun time to be,
be interested in golf, and you see a lot of neat stuff happening, no doubt.
Of course, northeastern Nebraska, where Rob and Tad are developing Landman, can get pretty chilly this time of year. Lucky for you, though, Line 4's new online shop is now open, with hoodies, sweatpants, wool caps, coffee mugs, plus a few things that probably won't help you survive a snowstorm, but still would be fun to have. I'm a particularly big fan of the Christmas at Contraband Bayou t-shirt. Just head over to line4.com and click on the shop link. From there, it's pretty self-explanatory. But it's a great way to support Line 4 storytelling and to stock up on some great gear to schlep through winter. And now back to the show. And back to Nathan Crace, who we heard from earlier in the podcast. Nathan is a Mississippi-based architect who co-designed Copper Mill Golf Course in Louisiana, and who's done a ton of really great renovation work at the Ole Miss Golf Course, at Hattiesburg Country Club in Mississippi, and was recently tapped by East Baton Rouge Parish in Louisiana to restore and renovate City Park, which is a 9-hole Tom Bendelow course that's nearly 100 years old. Hearing one architect say that business is picking up is a fairly anecdotal way of gauging whether the golf course design industry as a whole is seeing a resurgence. But in early October, Crace attended the annual meeting of the American Society of Golf Course Architects, or the ASGCA. And according to Crace, the consensus was more or less unanimous. Golf course design is back.
The ASGCA annual meeting was supposed to be in Cleveland last year, being of COVID. So we weren't able to have it, and we pushed it back. And then it actually coincided with our 75th anniversary of ASGCA. So that worked out pretty nice.
What goes on at these at an ASGCA meeting, at an annual meeting?
Well, there's a lot of education. We do get to play a little golf, which is fun, because we typically have some members who've done some work at some nice clubs in the area, and we get to go play. A lot of your board meetings and committee meetings and just the regular work of a nonprofit society that's trying to promote something, and we're trying to promote the game of golf and golf course architecture, of course. And so there's just not that different from like the GCSAA annual meeting or even the PGA annual meeting, not necessarily the PGA show, the merchandise show, but the annual meetings of those allied organizations. So the really unique thing about the ASGCA is it's like this fraternity of professionals, and we all do the same thing, and many times we compete for the same work, but we're all still friends. And so it was good to be able to get back in person and see everybody and kind of catch up, and it's always nice when you do it in person.
Well, following your Twitter account lately, it looks like you've been doing a lot of traveling. What have you been working on?
This is the first time that I can remember I have 4 projects that I've signed non-disclosure agreements on. And typically we want to keep this kind of under wraps until we're ready to announce it. But I think it's just a little more indicative of the times we're in, because golf has exploded, because of the pandemic. It was one of the only things you could go out and safely do. You can do it outside. You can naturally socially distance yourself from the people you're playing with, for the most part. A lot of people started walking again, which was great, because I think one thing we found out is that obesity or weight, being overweight, is one of the underlying conditions that a lot of people have struggled with. And it's not like we're a country of skinny athletes anyway. So myself included, I think everybody could stand to lose a few pounds probably.
Hand up.
But so anyway, but getting back to that, I think because it's so supercharged right now, you've got a lot of clients that want to kind of keep things quiet. A couple of them, it's because they're looking at buying property. One's looking at buying a closed golf course. They want to cross their T's and dot their I's, or cross their I's and dot their T's, however you want to look at it. And one's a nonprofit, one is a public agency. So, it's just a lot of it, but I just thought it was weird, because it's the first time I've had four that are out of that. And in reality, one, perhaps two, will be moving dirt next year. Could be three, would be 2023. So it's just, we're in that kind of weird time of year. It's hard to really start a project right now unless it's a full-blown renovation where you're going to start doing work, because, the grassing window is come and gone for small projects. But now we've been in, we've got projects in that I can talk about in Gulf Breeze, Florida, Tiger Point down there. A group of private owners got together and bought that from the city of Gulf Breeze and have really turned that golf course around. And so one of the things that we're doing there, and I don't know if you've played Tiger Point.
I have.
But yeah, it's a very large piece of property, and it winds to a lot of houses, but it's a lot of property maintained. It's about 200 acres total. You take the lakes out, it's probably 170, 175-ish, somewhere in there. So we're taking about 25 to 30 acres of maintained turf out and creating naturalized areas. I hate to say native areas because there's not really a lot native about the plants people usually put in those areas. But, you know, we're trying to decrease the amount of inputs that you put in to a golf course. As we've done, you know, the ASGCA members have been doing that for 20, 30 years, you know, so we've understood early on that if you can put fewer inputs into areas that don't come into play, then you can take that money and that time and that labor and put it into other areas like greens and tees and bunkers and things that the eye candy, as you would have it, that the golfers see. So, but continuing projects in Louisiana, Alabama, South Carolina, Mississippi, of course, Tennessee. So we're just, you know, we're all over the Southeast right now and still looking for that elusive project back home in the Midwest. You know, I grew up in Indiana, so I'm still waiting to, it's happened a few times. I thought we were close and things just didn't pan out. So still searching for that one. I think that would be a lot of fun to get back home and do one back there.
Well, when you get a project like what you're working on at Tiger Point, like how does that start? Does somebody call you saying, you know, somebody call with a specific request, like, hey, we're looking to take out 25, 30 acres of turf to try to get fewer inputs? Or is it a vaguer ask that they bring you in and start looking for suggestions?
Well, Tiger Point specifically, I can answer that question for you, but each one's different. You know, some projects, we do a lot of public projects. Those usually start with an RFP, request for proposals. Sometimes it's a phone call. Sometimes the superintendent follows me on Twitter, for example, and says, hey, we're looking at doing this project. Would you mind giving us some input? A lot of times we'll make a site visit, initial site visit, and meet with the owner and start kind of bouncing ideas around. Sometimes you find right away that you click and you have the same ideas that they have. And then there are other times where you realize that what they want to do is either financially infeasible or just impossible. You know, they something that they want to do and it's just not a good fit for the golf course, or you know, you can kind of tell in the long term. So there are times when we have to say no to projects, and I hate to do that sometimes, but you're also looking in the long term. But Tiger Point was actually a mutual friend of the owner and myself, which the owner and I didn't know each other, even though he was also a Mississippi State graduate. But a mutual friend reached out and said, hey, I know this guy, he's part of a group that's buying Tiger Point and Gulf Breeze. They're wanting to do some work. Would you mind if I give him your name? Absolutely, go ahead. And so went down, met with them. And it was one of those deals where we just clicked. I mean, we had the same ideas. We had the same thoughts and things from the get-go. And I think part of that may also go back to the fact that, you know, I went to Mississippi State for the professional golf management program because when I was growing up, nobody in my family played golf. You know, so I was this kid in Indiana. Age 10, saw golf on TV, liked it, saw it the next week on TV, different golf course. I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. And so I just kind of fell in love with the game that way. My parents had a little bit of land, so I went out and built a 3-hole golf course, taught myself how to play reading Jack Nicklaus's Golf My Way book. And, played 4 years of varsity golf in high school, but not good enough to, you know, play at the collegiate level. But I knew I wanted to design golf courses by the time I was 10 or 11 years old, but there was just no way to do it. So my thinking was, and we got this flyer in the mail from Mississippi State about professional golf management. At the time, it was one of the only three programs in the state, in the country that had it. The other two were Ferris State and Michigan. And you know, by the end of October, they're not playing golf up there anymore in Northern Michigan. And then New Mexico State and Las Cruces had just started the program at that time. This was 1989, 1990, something like that. And my parents weren't crazy about me leaving Indiana and going to Las Cruces, New Mexico at age 18. So we ended up in Mississippi State and I fell in love with it and fell in love with the people there. And but the point being that I wanted to learn the business side of golf. I wanted to know how a golf course operated, why it operated that way, maybe how design impacted maintenance and vice versa. And I think a lot of that, I've been doing golf courses now for 26 years. And I think a large part of our success, both individually and the firm, is that experience kind of blend. We're not just looking at eye candy. That's important, but there are times when you can kind of balance those two out, be both effective and efficient, and help the client out in the long run. So,
well, speaking of the business side of things, you just got back from the ASGC annual meeting, so you probably have some insight on this. Like, where do you think the state of the industry is right now relative to where it was maybe 36 months ago? Is business picking up? Is it kind of level or what?
Yeah, no. I, every single member that I talked to, all everyone was talking about was how busy we are right now compared to, 2 years ago. There were a lot of us, well, not myself included, because I try to be optimistic, but 4 years ago or so, 3-4 years ago, a lot of people were really concerned that golf was on the way, not necessarily on the way out, but was going to be severely suppressed in participation. And as bad as COVID has been, it's strange how sometimes how these things can change the way we as humans not only interact with each other, but the way things happen recreationally and the way things rebuild. I mean, we're no stranger to it here on the Gulf Coast, where you have a hurricane that comes through, and as awful as it is, and you hate to see it, typically 5, 10, 15 years later, things come back bigger and better than they were before. And there's no better showing of that than three counties along the Gulf Coast and Mississippi. So they have roared back after Katrina. So I think in a way, maybe we look back 15 years from now and say, this is crazy, but much like the Spanish flu in 1917, when people were encouraged to get out and beat the flu by getting outside and playing golf, maybe COVID ends up doing the same thing for golf 100 years later.
Either from your own portfolio right now or your what you're hearing from your colleagues in Cleveland, are there any patterns that you're noticing about things that courses are looking for, or is it just kind of all over the map?
Well, we actually, one of the things that we did was we did internal polling. I can't get into that, but we did a lot of internal polling to kind of see the way the industry is going. And then we share that with other allied industries within golf. We do that because, again, we don't want to just take off running blind. We need to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the industry and what people are looking for and what the end user wants. But I think in broad strokes, making golf fun, making it cost effective, making it something that younger people continue to want to get involved in and keep coming to. And I think, years ago, I can remember they used to have, the top 10 hardest golf courses. And there were people who owned these golf courses who wanted to be on that list. And that never really made sense to me. I mean, I guess it was kind of, we're 8,000 yards from the tips and, good luck breaking 80 out here if you're a one handicap. But most people, the vast majority of people don't want that. They don't want to feel beat up when they leave the 18th. They only want to have fun. And now, here's a perfect example. I'm doing some work for a recreational authority that owns a few golf courses. And one of the things that we're doing is we're studying holes where tee shots didn't used to be a problem for adjacent property. And now we've got a lot of young, athletic, mostly male golfers that are coming into the game. I say mostly male, the ones that this issue arises from, and they want to get up there and they love the long ball. You know, they want to get up there and just kill it. You know, just like that you see the TikTok videos where guys are trying to, you know, hit it over the fence at the end of the Top Golf, so or over the net. And so we have places on some of these golf courses where now a house that used to be well outside of the, you know, angle of dispersion for a bad shot, because they were 280 yards off the tee and way left. Well, now that house is getting balls in the backyard. And so one of the things that we're doing without trying to trick it up is adding tees, angling tees, maybe adding a bunker or moving a bunker and kind of shifting fairways to realign the center line of a hole and things like that. So there's a lot of that going on, a lot of bunker renovation. And those are the types of things that for us, a lot of those clients are projects that we discussed years ago and they just kind of put them on the back burner. And now with an increase in play and more cash, they are ready to start making these capital investments. And a lot of places we're starting to see now, we're getting calls from people that said, you know, the last 18 months, the traffic on the golf course, and I have a client that's a private club. They went from 28,000 rounds, which is a pretty good, to 42,000 rounds they're on pace for this year. And it's a private club, so their tees weren't built big enough for that kind of traffic. And there's infrastructure work that needs to be done, things like that. So it's a confluence of a number of things, but it was striking to me when we would sit around and talk in the evenings or just during a breakout session, how everyone was dealing nationwide with the kind of the same issues with all their clients. So, but you know, number one, people want their golf experience to be fun. Owners want it to be profitable, but you know, maintainable and still look good. And the end user wants to be able to get out there and have a good time and bring their friends and not feel beat up when they get done.
It's funny you mentioned the sort of the direct impact on golf courses from the COVID uptick in play. I was working on a story last year for the Golfers Journal, reaching out to some architects and saying, with these clubs getting a little more revenue in, what sorts of things should they be looking at, you know, as possible targets for that revenue? What can they do with that money to set themselves up better 5 years, 10 years from now? And I remember one person's answer was new tee boxes. And that doesn't sound like a very sexy answer, but he said, you know, if you're getting a lot more play than usual, especially on par threes, those tee boxes get chewed up real fast. And I'd never thought of that.
In short par fours, where when the course was built maybe 20 years ago, some people were hitting drivers, some people were hitting fairway woods, hybrids didn't exist. And now you've got people who are having to hit a four or five iron off the tee on some of these holes to keep the ball in play, you know, so there are a lot of things like that. But anyway, you were saying.
Well, I was just going to ask, like, what are the differences you're seeing now with, you know, courses that are getting back into the business of, you know, really investing in the golf course versus what you might have seen in the 1990s when there was a lot of work going on?
You know, in the 1990s, it was a lot of wooden bulkheads, bunkers for the sake of what would look good in the pages of Golf Digest. And everybody wanted a longer and longer golf course, you know, because technology was really starting to take off back then. And if you go back and look at, you know, I wrote a column for 8 years called Lip Outs, which is the reason that's my Twitter handle. But if you go back to lipouts.com and those columns go back to 2001, occasionally you'll see one or two where I may have been a little critical of the USGA for what I said was, you know, letting the golf ball kind of get away from them. And I didn't blame them. I don't think there was any nefarious reason behind it. I just think that a lot of manufacturers came to them and said, look, people love to see these guys hit it 300 yards. People love to hit the ball better. They love to make it, you know, we're trying to make the club head on the driver as big as we can so we make it more forgiving. So I think there was, they had a lot of good intentions behind it. But sometimes, you know, Murphy's Law kicks in and you have unintended consequences. And that one of the lines that I wrote about was that now, instead of a guy being 240 yards off the tee in the right rough, he's now 275 off the tee, but he's two fairways over or in somebody's backyard or somebody's front yard. So there was a lot of that, and it happened so quickly that people had a hard time keeping up with it. So it's a little different now. I think a lot of that kind of plateaued out. You know, Bryson DeChambeau is, you know, that's an outlier. That's, you know, that's like comparing basketball players as a whole to what Michael Jordan did in his prime. But the what we did in the 90s was a lot of new construction, a lot of how long can we make this golf course, put as many bunkers in there as we can, big, huge greens. And now we've kind of reverted back. And a lot of that was from the economic problems, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where things kind of had to dial back. You know, we still, I believe, have more courses closed than open every year, which sounds strange, but it's, again, it's a market correction. I've had courses that I built that have closed, and it's sad to see it happen, but it inevitably helps the other courses in the market when that happens, like any other market correction does. So that's a little different than what we have now. And now it's more infrastructure. It's more kind of decreasing the footprint, trying to, and sustainability has kind of become a catchword, but, you know, lessen inputs. And again, it's kind of what I say, balancing efficiency and effectiveness. And that's one of the topics we actually discussed in depth, was, you know, how to make things more efficient in design going forward. That's a big part. There's a lot. You said that tees didn't sound very sexy. Tell you what else is not very sexy is irrigation and drainage, because both of them live in the ground and nobody ever sees them until something's wrong with it, or you need more of either, or less irrigation or more. So, you know, we're trying to dial in. Technology's played a big role in that, in Rainbird and Toro and these other companies, where you can really dial in your water and get a lot more efficient. Problem right now is you can't get pipe, you know, so it's just, we start running into these supply chain issues, and we are no stranger to that, like anybody else is.
That global supply chain crisis, to which Collins and Crace both have alluded, has made its presence felt in virtually every segment of the economy. If you've seen bare shelves at your local Target, or haven't been able to find a box of Crunchberry cereal at the grocery store, then you can thank the supply chain crisis. And the crisis is no less inconvenient in golf course construction.
Helping Brian Schneider at Lanark Country Club out in Philly, 9 holes 1 year, 9 holes the next year. So I think 2019 was the first phase, and they didn't have sand. So I think they had to let their bunkers sit over winter, and then they put sand in them in the spring when they could get it. So for the following year, they just ordered enough and had a place to set it. So they let it sit on site for, you know, what seemed like several months to me, just so that they knew they had it.
That's Blake Conant, a golf course architect from Nebraska, who's worked with Tom Doak's Renaissance Golf Design Group and is co-designing Old Barnwell Golf Course, where construction is nearly underway in South Carolina. Blake has seen golf course construction from pretty much every level of involvement, so he understands that even seemingly insignificant holdups can have major downstream effects. What are you working on these days?
So I'm up in Salem at Salem Country Club helping. Eric Iverson is the consulting architect there. And they've, you know, they didn't have much to do. It was just like getting 20% better, 10 to 20% better of the details, like expanding some greens, redoing the bunkers, and just getting more detail into those based on some old photos we've got. So helping Eric out there, was in Oklahoma for most of the summer, running the job for Tom at Dornick Hills, rebuilding all the greens and generally just restoring what Perry Maxwell had there.
Not sure how to lead into this, but I guess I just have to expose my own nerdiness on this. I follow enough folks in the golf design and golf construction business to kind of feel like I had a pretty good pace for how things were going in terms of, you know, how often new work kind of gets announced. And just in the, like, the last 12, 6 months, it's just kind of felt like that stuff was popping up on Twitter and Instagram and everything more often. Is that fair? Like, is it picking up?
No, I think that's fair that it's picking up, but, you know, that's a result of at least a year, if not 2 or 3 years of planning. So like I helped Eric develop the plans for Salem, but that was kind of right at the start of the pandemic. So then you trace that back. The internal conversations at the club had clearly been going on for some time before then. But every club's different. It's like, you know, I do think the pandemic and just the influx of golf that happened that season, a lot of clubs were very conservative and didn't know how to handle it. And then when a couple of months went by and it's, you know, holy shit, we're doing 25%, 30% more revenue as compared to last year. I think that particularly made clubs like flip a switch of, okay, there's going to be a ton of competition for golf. How can we separate ourselves? So maybe you're starting to see some of that work and some of those ideas that were birthed during the pandemic start to happen this fall. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely an uptick, and we see it on our side of, you could maybe call a contractor, you know, 3 months in advance. You're having to get your bid work out of the way 6 months in advance, 8 months in advance. Those guys are just really booked up. Same with materials, same with irrigation designers, irrigation contractors. So from our side, that's where we see it, is you're just having to plan that much farther in advance.
When you and I were swapping DMs on Twitter several days ago about this conversation, you mentioned pipe specifically as something that y'all were having a hard time getting your hands on. In the, you know, with step one being you break ground and step 10,000 being you open up, like, mm-hmm. where on that timeline does pipe go in the ground?
So we get stuff shaped, and then the first thing to really happen after that is irrigation goes in. Now, typically what'll happen, like if you're shaping a green and you're doing it to USGA spec, what you'll do is you'll let the contractor construct the green to get the mix in, because if irrigation goes in without mix, it'll collapse the weld that you've made. So it'll, you know, the integrity of the shaping gets lost a bit if they do that. So sometimes you can get out of order. But you can also think of it in terms of like layering stuff underground. So what's the deepest thing you're going to put in the ground? That's probably mainline pipe or your big trunk line drainage. So mainlines at like 3 feet or 4 feet deep, depending on your drain pipe, that could be as, but the thing you want to avoid is anybody who's digging a trench or doing like a little ditch witch with a trencher, they don't want to have to stop every 75 feet and hand dig to go under or over a pipe. So you always want to lay stuff going from deepest to shallowest. So typically what that means is you'll try to get as much of your drainage in before your irrigation, but everything's kind of then, you've got to shape, for us, we've got to shape it once. We've got to let it get blown up through all the construction processes. And then we basically have to go back in and hopefully don't have to reshape it all, but you usually have to touch stuff up and get those little details back.
Well, then are there any other parts of the process that get held up when, you know, you can't get enough pipe?
Yeah, but there are ways, you know, there are ways around it. So what we like to say is like, just inch the ball forward however you can. You know, if there's a hang up, you can't let it stop the entire project. But what you can do is, like at Dornick Hills, we didn't have enough pipe for, we didn't have enough solid 4-inch pipe for the outfalls for the green drainage. So what you'll do is you'll stub something up, you'll finish everything around it, and then maybe you'll leave like, you'll leave a little gap in the sod where they can come back, dig that trench fully. You know, you just want to make sure that when you're kind of hedging like that, that you're not messing up another operation. So you kind of have to think like, okay, we don't have this pipe. We can complete XYZ tasks, but then the tasks that need to get done after this, like, how do we not get in there or what to? And a lot of that is just like conversations between us, between the contractor, between the superintendent, like, you know, is this 2 weeks out and can we survive it? Can we go somewhere else for those 2 weeks? Or like, is this 2 months out and we need to kind of readjust our entire game plan? So Dornick Hills, yeah, like Dornick Hills is a great example. They had ordered some pipe. It got bought out from under them. Somebody bid 2 or 3 times more than what they were paying for it. And the supplier just sold it. So we were left kind of holding them back. But you know, it was just like, hey, there's nothing else you can do. So how do we construct the greens? Because your seeding window doesn't change, right? It's like the greens still need to get seeded at X date. You can't push that off because you don't have a certain amount of pipe. So yeah, you're just constantly like having to creative problem solve.
What do you do in that situation then? I mean, if you got to put the seed down at a certain time, but you don't have the pipe yet.
Yeah. So we had enough pipe, on site to actually construct the green and the green well. So we could get the internal green drainage done. We could get the mix in there. It was just the outfall pipe, the solid pipe that we had to figure out what to do with. So that's like the example I gave earlier of you've got to stub something out and just, you know, whatever is infiltrating from the green and outfalling there, it would typically run through a solid pipe into some type of outlet, like in a creek or, you know, off in the woods or something. That we just had to daylight closer than we normally would, make sure it wasn't going to wash anything out in the meantime, and wait for this back order of pipe that we had. So I think that was like a 6 to 8 week delay for that pipe. But it was something that's like, okay, we can construct all the greens. Our seeding window is still, you know, we're still a go for that. So as long as we can mitigate this one little thing, like, we'll be fine.
Kind of looking longer term ahead, assuming that these supply chain problems continue, is it a situation that you can sort of creatively navigate like this indefinitely? Or can you imagine, you know, a time down the road where it just fundamentally takes longer to do construction than it does right now?
Maybe. What you might see, and what the superintendent Brent Waite at Dornick Hills was clever, he ordered all his irrigation pipe like close to a year in advance. And this was before there was really a supply chain problem. They just wanted to get the materials on site. And now that's like the reward you may see in the future is almost like commodities trading of let's get the pipe on site. Maybe it goes down in price and we made a bad deal and we've got more expensive pipe sitting on the ground, or maybe it ends up being worth twice as much and it was great that we bought it when we did. So for Brent, that worked out really well, and for the club. But I, you know, getting back to what I was saying of like, we've got to call contractors earlier because they've got to call suppliers earlier. I think you're just, yeah, you're seeing people have to be much more proactive. And I do think the supply chain is starting to even out a bit more.
Where are you going the rest of the year?
I'll be in Salem for another month or so. just kind of in and out, and then may help a little bit with a couple other projects on the East Coast. And then Old Barnwell, a project that Brian Schneider and I are working on, we're starting to clear it now. So that'll be getting online in January, hopefully.
Tell me about Old Barnwell, because it's funny you mentioned that. That is one of the courses projects that when I saw that kind of start showing up on social media, it occurred to me like, oh, there seem to be more of these showing up than there were a couple of years ago. And maybe there's something to that. So tell me about Old Barnwell.
Yeah. So Old Barnwell, it'll be a new development, new golf course in the greater Aiken area. It's like 10 miles out east of Aiken, a little town called Windsor. Brian Schneider and I are co-designing it. And, you know, it's a younger client, which we're seeing a lot of too, just with like what comes across Renaissance Golf's desk, what comes across Tom's desk.
Tom is Tom Doak, obviously.
It's just more like there's work coming online, but it seems like the clients are, you know, it's not older, wealthy guys with money. Sometimes, you know, more so now it's younger, ambitious guys, or gals. And that's kind of what this was. Nick reached out to me just kind of randomly.
Nick is Nick Schreiber, who coincidentally went to high school with Andy Johnson from the Fried Egg.
We'd been on Golf Club Atlas. There was a thread about like cool sandy ground that people don't know of, you know, and it's like, where in the world is cool sandy ground? So talking about like Georgia and South Carolina, like the old coastline. And so Nick just reached out to me. He's like, hey, I was going to develop a golf course. Like, do you know of any specific piece of land that would be for this? And the conversation just kind of went from there. And it just so happens, it's like we had a pretty big radius of where to look, and where we finally found a really cool piece of ground is like, I think less than 10 miles from where the tree farm's getting developed. So that'll be actually like, that's really cool. And in my mind, it's, you know, anchored by this great city of Aiken. It's kind of a high tide raises all boats thing. Two courses getting built at the same time. It'll have some hopefully pretty high architectural pedigree. And yeah, we're excited.
You can probably guess where all this is leading. All these forces, increased demand, supply shortages, labor shortages, they all lead to one place, and that's higher costs. And that's without even mentioning the rising rate of inflation, which, well, let's just say it's a thing right now. The point is, it's great that golf course construction is having a resurgence. It's good for golf, it's good for golfers. But it's only a matter of time before the forces that golf course construction is navigating result in higher prices for developers and ultimately for end users, that is, rank and file golfers. So whether the demand for new golf course construction, for new designs, for quality renovation work, whether that demand remains intact for the foreseeable future depends ultimately on whether demand remains high. In other words, it depends on us. Well, that's episode 6 of the Line 4 podcast. If you enjoyed the listen, then please consider subscribing and leaving a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. The Line 4 podcast comes out about once per month and is a production of the Line 4 blog at www.line4.com. A friend recently told me never to refer to this effort as a blog, but to call it a multimedia company. So thanks for reading and listening to my multimedia company. And hey, don't forget to visit my multimedia company's online shop at www.line4.com/shop. This has been the Line 4 Podcast. I'm Will Bardwell, signing off.